court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. You'll notice a couple of empty chairs. Everyone is going to be here. We have a fire alarm that's going to go off at 11 o'clock, so we won't start the oral argument until that occurs, because it'd be silly. We're about 4 minutes away right now. But I wanted us to get together because we have a different breakdown of how the argument is going to be conducted, and I want to be sure that we're all on the same page in regard to that and that all counsel is aware. So first we're going to have Attorney Horning for 20 minutes, and then you have ceded part of your time to the amicus, and Attorney Fassbender is going to then argue for the amicus for 5 minutes. then Attorney Della Lava. Thank you. Say it again. Della Vita. That's a beautiful name. You will have 30 minutes then to respond, and then we'll go back for the usual rebuttal. I would urge you, counsel, 5 minutes is very hard to do when you're not doing rebuttal. But I do watch the time because I want both sides to have a fair opportunity, and that includes having a fair amount of time on both sides. So do watch it. I think it's really tough to do, but, you know, you may have a point or two that you can make in 5 minutes that'll be just exactly the right point. So we're anxious to hear from you, but I can tell you, past experience is there are few attorneys that can actually accomplish much in 5 minutes unless you're doing rebuttal and you've got a point or two to make. So, you know, we can just enjoy each other's company for a couple of minutes because the alarm is going to go off. And Justice Ann Walsh Bradley will be out shortly as well. So,
back there. I'll be right back.
Yeah. Okay. That's fine. Kind of like being in church. You sit here and should you talk or not talk, waiting for the preacher to show up, right? This will probably be the first time that the fire alarm will go off that I won't visibly jump. It always frightens me, even though I remind everyone. But today, since we're sitting and waiting, certainly I'll be prepared. So I hope you all will be too. It's very loud and very noisy, but it's necessary. So the first Wednesday of every month at 11 o'clock, we have a fire drill. keep waiting. I heard him made the announcement, but I don't hear the alarm. In here are a little quieter now. Even though you could probably argue, let's wait till it's all done, because this room is hard to hear in. So. Here we go. Okay, I will now begin the arguments on Lamar versus Division of Hearing and Appeals. Please proceed, counsel.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I feel honored that the entire Capitol knows that I'm about to start my oral argument. I am Thomas Stone Hornig, and I'm appearing here with my partner, Craig A. Byron, both of Von Breesen and Roper, Madison, and representing the petitioners Lamar and TLC. I'll refer to both as Lamar. This case concerns Lamar's would-be loss of a valuable asset due to the Wisconsin Department of Transportation issuing a sign removal order, or SRO, if you will, for the uncompensated removal of this nonconforming sign. The Department of Transportation did this because of an alleged single violation of a rule concerning how such sign was to be lawfully maintained, pardon me, which alleged violation was not in play, did not exist, for 4 years prior to the issuance of the SRO. When the SRO was issued, the sign was in full conformity with the rules concerning the maintenance of such a sign. Even DOT admits that there was nothing wrong with it for 4 years prior. The Division of Hearings and Appeals, whose decision will be reviewed here, affirmed DOT's SRO based upon an incorrect construction of Section 84.30 of the statutes and Trans 20110 of the Wisconsin Administrative Code, and it gave DOT a pass where it should have held that it was incumbent upon DOT under the circumstances to engage in rulemaking if it indeed wished to prohibit all extensions and wished to avoid giving the alleged erring party, in this case Lamar, a 60-day notice of right to cure as specified in Section 8430 sub 11 and 8430 sub 5 sub BR sub 4. I beg the Court's indulgence to make two corrections, two briefs that we filed in this case. At times, we fail to include the full citation to Section 84.30, sub 5, sub BR 4, occasionally omitting the sub 5 in that citation. We apologize for that. And also, the effective date of Act 320, which is where 8430, sub 5, sub BR 4 comes from. The effective date was actually April 17 of 1918. We said 17. Please forgive us for that. The act year was a 1917 year, but the enactment was a year later, 1918.
And that's 2017 and 2018?
Yes.
Thank you.
We erroneously indicated 17. It should be 18, Justice. There is no legal prohibition on enlarging a nonconforming off-premise sign erected after March 18 of 1972, which is the effective date of the so-called Wisconsin mirror law, because it is patterned after the Highway Beautification Act. The sign removal order in this case cited to two different authorities as the basis for the claimed illegality of this sign. The first was Section 84.30, sub 5, sub BM, and that section, everyone agrees, applies to only on-premises signs. The sign in question is undeniably an off-premises sign. So that section, everyone pretty much has ignored, including the Court of Appeals, again, more or less on agreement of the parties. The only other authority cited in the sign removal order for why this sign was illegal is Trans 201.10 sub 2 sub E, which applies, it is our position, only to signs existing on March 18 of 1972.
If you read it that way, counsel, isn't it true that it goes against the purpose of the stated purpose of the statutes here and the Trans 201.01, which is to phase out nonconforming signs? If you read it the way you're reading it, anything that's been erected as of 1972 can be changed in any way anybody wants to, right? I mean, all these things don't apply in terms of nonconforming, right?
Respectfully, Justice Gallant, we disagree and disagree firmly. First of all, all of the rules in the common law relative to enhancement or change of uses of nonconforming signs, structures, or uses, would come to play.
Which is a different argument you're making, but we've got a statute here, and we've got rules from the rulemaking, so don't we have to follow those and not the common law?
I'm sorry?
Don't we have to follow the statute and the rules and not the common law when we've got statute and rules that tell us what we should do?
I would agree, except it seems to us that if the legislature and even in Trans 201 was intended to mean what you say that it means, it could have been written vastly more clearly and easily than it was attempted to be done in this case.
We could say that about a lot of things the legislature writes, right? But we also have to read it in a reasonable way that makes sense of everything. It makes sense of the statutes and these administrative rules and the purpose behind both of them, the stated purpose. We're not looking at legislative intent. We're looking at what they were trying to do that they said they were trying to do, right?
Well, that's very true. But as you also indicated, oftentimes the legislature fails to fulfill the stated purpose that's stated at the outset. And in this case, we take the position that they did. I understand the point, but respectfully, we don't think that's what the law says.
Okay, thank you.
Are you making any argument that the Schoolway case should be modified or overruled? I didn't see it in your briefs.
Our position would be that the court has an opportunity to address what was said in Schoolways and to perhaps to sharpen up the rules that come out of that case to an extent. But the Schoolways case in no way is an impediment to our position here. In fact, it's an ideal case that sets up this case for you all to consider. As you know, Justice Walsh Bradley, there was actually two different instances of changes that were reflected in that case. One, in which the court held that no rule was required, and the second, that a rule was required. It sets up beautifully as to how you might compare to the present situation. Obviously, we take the view, but I think it's compelling that the second situation, where a rule was held to be required, is closer by analogy to the situation that we have here. In the first instance, where the department was given a pass and where the court held no rule was required, actually the language of the statute was so impeccably clear. And yet was being violated by the department that the court simply said it was not necessary for a rule to be enacted before it could be enforced that way. If I can just find the case quickly here. The language was not only clear in one way, but it was actually clear in two different ways. It said, first of all, it said a school bus owned, operated, or under contract with a private or public school or college and used exclusively for transportation of students can qualify for this lesser rate. But the language wasn't content, the legislature wasn't content with just saying that. They then followed that up with another subsection which said, when engaged in passenger carrying operations other than as provided in the section I just read, such school buses shall register and pay the fees for motor buses provided in another section. So in two different ways, they came at it and said, the department shall not allow this particular company to pay the lesser rate, and yet the department did it anyway.
When I asked my question about the case, the school aid case, it was based on my reading of your briefs, and I did not see in the briefs that you're requesting that it be overruled. Is that correct?
Yes, our brief did not indicate that it should be overruled. I think so the argument simply was that our situation is analogous to the second case in Schoolways and is not as to the first.
Mm-hmm. So there's nothing that you're advancing that would say Schoolway framework should not be applied. It's just what part of it should be applied. Am I getting that correctly?
I think you are, Justice, and I would say yes. We would urge the court to apply Schoolways just the way it was written because we feel that we would come out just fine if that was the case. I think Amicus may have an additional point or two to make on the subject, and there's, again, this court has an opportunity to sharpen the focus, perhaps, of the rulemaking requirements because. There's one other point I failed to make a minute ago. The Court of Appeals in this case referred to an error-correcting exception and stated it rather broadly. And I shouldn't speak for Mr. Fassbender, but I think that's what got the attention of his clients in this case. That is a conceivably very broad exception, one that the concern is that may be so broad that many agencies will decide to drive a truck through it and avoid rulemaking wherever possible. And that is a danger, the way the law is working. And it was a danger here to Lamar, and they got trapped by it.
Counsel, I want to talk a little bit about subsection 11, okay?
Yes.
And the change that was made in, as you pointed out earlier, in 5BR.
Yes.
Okay. Now, if 5BR applies to this sign, that's really the end of the story for us, isn't it?
If 5BR applies to this sign, the appellants win and the case is over, yes.
Okay. And if you look at how the department interpreted subsection 11 before 5BR came into existence, they were giving a 60-day pass. And as I read it and what they did before they changed the rules, it appeared to me the department was interpreting subsection 11 as applying not only to illegal signs, which seems to be what everybody says it applies to now, but to any sign, even nonconforming signs, that may have done something that's inconsistent with their status as nonconforming. They gave the 60-day window.
Okay,
and then they stopped giving the 60-day window, and there's an argument that they couldn't do that without rulemaking.
That's correct.
And when they stopped doing that, what did the legislature do? Well, it enacted 5BR. So my question to you is it reasonable for me to conclude that subsection 11 was being interpreted by DOT prior to 5BR as giving a 60-day corrective period to nonconforming as well as illegal signs. So they would fix the problem. The idea was to keep people in compliance, not to take away their property. And can you respond to that?
I could not have said it better. Absolutely correct. You're completely right on. The record, we would urge the court to perhaps, if necessary, spend just a few minutes on the testimony of Robert Hardy, which is in the appendix. Of course, I can get you the pages if it would be helpful. Mr. Hardy made it very clear that he, as the statewide sign permit coordinator, the fellow at the top of the pyramid for enforcement purposes, not only he, during his approximately 10-year tenure, followed this policy of issuing the right to cure under 84-30-11, but his predecessor, Bill Brinkley, who was, if you will, the George Washington of the process, he was the one that was there and created the whole way in which DOT operated under this brand new statute, 84-30, he also followed that same process, and that was from 1972 to 1989. So from 72 to 99, the department granted that right, interpreting, obviously, that statute in the way that you suggest. Then Mr. Hardy retired. In hindsight, we regret that. He retired. And Ms. Brukaya then happened to be his successor, and she and her administration simply took a different view, and all of a sudden, that right to cure, that opportunity to fix the problem, to fix the small problem and retain the balance of the sign, that went away. And we're saying that simply demanded a rule be enacted before they could enforce the law in that fashion.
I have one other question on the statute, and it's on 5BR. And the initial applicability says this act first applies to non-conforming signs in existence on the date of this subsection. So if, in fact, the new rule that doesn't let you correct were not there, your sign would still be non-conforming. It wouldn't be illegal, correct?
Chief Justice, I missed something there in the middle of your...
Well, I was looking at, you know, obviously the statute came about after all of these proceedings against Lamar started with DOT, right?
Right.
Okay. And then the legislature passed this statute, and the initial applicability said it first applies to non-conforming signs in existence on the effective date of the statute. So if your non-conforming sign that got out of whack could be fixed, in order for this statute not to apply, your sign would have to be illegal. But if you could bring it back to non-conforming status by fixing the problem, then it's possible that the statute enacted later on applies to yours, your sign.
Yes, I agree. And that's the crux of the issue with respect to 5BR. The division takes the position that the sign on the first day that an extension appeared on that sign became illegal.
That's right.
And was forevermore illegal, and there was nothing anyone could do about it. Our position is simply until there's a final adjudication in this case, that sign would have to be considered to be continue to be classified as non-conforming, therefore subject to 5.
I think that's another way around the bush. I was more looking at it that this, to apply this provision to Lamar's sign, it has to be illegal at the time the law was enacted.
Oh, no, no.
But if you could fix it so that there was a problem with the non-conforming sign, and within it was already fixed before this. If the fixing was possible to bring it back into non-conforming status.
Which clearly it was, by the way, physically. All we had to do is take off the extension.
Right, yeah. Right. Okay.
Sure.
Counsel, 5B, I'm sorry.
I had two things first. I want to follow up on something you just said first, and that is, so you said until a final adjudication, the sign is still considered non-conforming. What would be the final adjudication that would render it illegal if it wasn't rendered illegal from the time that extensions were put on? What does that look like?
I guess this court affirming that the sign removal order was issued correctly.
What if you never appealed your decision? Isn't it the DOT's finding that it was?
Well, Justice Dallet, there's an end of the road. Whether there's an appeal after appeal, as unfortunately there has been here, and we're now here, But this is the end of the road. Had we not appealed it and the time had run, then that would have been the end of the road.
Okay, all right. And my other question had to do with the sub-11. If they had never applied that 60-day time period at all and had just had never given the 60-day window to change change a sign that had become nonconforming, would you still argue that rulemaking is required? I mean, is your argument that no matter what, this is an ambiguous statute, or it only became that way because of how it was first interpreted?
It adds to our argument that from 1972 to 1999, it was interpreted that way by the department. It adds
right.
to our argument.
But what if it wasn't?
Forgive me, Justice. I didn't
yeah,
mean
sorry.
To, okay. HY 19.09, as we argue in our brief, was a rule that came out almost contemporaneously with the effective date of 8430. And the language of that rule is extremely helpful to our position. I would like to find it if you would like me to quote it. Let me see if I can quickly here. I have it right here. Sometimes I get lucky. HY 19.09 provided as follows. Any sign erected after March 18, 1972, and not permitted by the commission, that doesn't really apply, or permitted signs which subsequently become nonconforming, this is our sign, with respect to Section 84.30 Wisconsin statutes, or these rules shall be removed in accordance with Section 84.30.11 Wisconsin statutes. Now, that was the initial rule passed contemporaneously with 8430 sub-11. Now, that then went away when Trans 201 came about, but Trans 201 didn't really speak to the issue. And so here you have an actual authority supporting our position. And then, in addition, you've got all these years of two different state sign permit coordinators interpreting it 8430 sub-11 that way, and then all of a sudden there's a change.
So it sounds like your answer to my question is yes, no matter what, because of how it came about, even if it hadn't given that 60-day window, you would argue that rulemaking still needs to be done because it doesn't fall within the school way first scenario. It falls within the school way second
yes,
scenario.
Yes, okay. I agree, Justice.
Okay, thank you.
Chief Justice, may I ask a question?
If you can't save it for rebuttal, you can.
Well, I'd like to have the other side have an opportunity
okay,
to respond
well,
to it. All right, so, Council, 5BR4 applies to signs described by 5BR2. Is that correct?
Forgive me, Justice. I didn't quite get it.
Sure, no worries. 5BR4 applies to signs described in 5BR2. Is that correct?
I'm going to have to grab it quick. I believe so, but let me just...
So 5BR4 says, except as provided in the subdivision, to make a substantial change to a sign described in subdivision. Goes on.
Sorry.
First.
Okay, 5BR4 applies to signs in 5BR2. Was that the question?
Correct.
Okay, I'm trying to now find it here. Four. Okay.
It's right at the beginning of 5BR4, except as provided in the subdivision.
Okay, to make a substantial change to sign described in sub 2, or to erect additional signs. Okay, I think I'm with you so far, yes.
Okay, so that applies. So 5BR4 applies to signs described by 5BR2, is that correct?
I think so.
Okay.
If I read it correctly.
And then 5BR2 refers to signs described by sub 3A, D, E, F and H, right? Which sign, which of those does your sign fit into?
How long do I have?
You're right.
let me see if I can.
Well, if you want to take a look at that while next council comes up, we can address that in rebuttal.
That would be fine, Jeff.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
please the court. My name is Robert Fassbender. I'm counsel for the five business organizations that filed the amicus brief. That brief focused on administrative law components of this case, namely the appellate court's proclamation that there is a error-correcting exemption to rulemaking. We would dispute such an exemption. Last count, there's over 70-some statutory exemptions to rulemaking, none relating to error-correcting. With respect to Schoolway and the premise of this, I think Schoolway is very helpful providing a litmus test and one of the key criteria, or the key criteria, for rulemaking. That is, in 227.10 sub 1, agencies must promulgate as rules its interpretations of statutes that it adopts to govern its enforcement. Schoolway situation, which is very unusual because the situation was there was no interpretation of the statutes. The buses had to be exclusively used for hauling children to school, and they were not. The court said that that is not an interpretation of statutes, and this is what's really important here for us, is that interpretation of the statutes is an element of rulemaking, not an exception, as the Court of Appeals would suggest.
Counsel, and I know the time is short, so I just want to just have a couple quick questions here. If you're an agency and you feel like a statute should be applied in one way, but it's not the way you're currently applying it, the implication of your position might be they cannot apply it. They think it ought to apply until they go through the lengthier process of rulemaking. Is that correct? I'm just wondering practically how that plays out. I get your statutory argument on the rule, but I'm just trying to think through the implications of that.
Well, in this situation, when they changed their interpretation, it was an interpretation. From our perspective, the protections that afforded to regulated community administrative rulemaking needs to be followed. And in the meantime, they can't enforce that interpretation until they follow 227 rulemaking procedures. I'm not sure if I got to the crux of your question.
But essentially, I'm asking, you know, it seems to me that the rationale for Schoolway and what the Court of Appeals was thinking, and again, you can respond to this, was essentially requiring rulemaking doesn't mean you can't enforce the law in that way. And so what happens if you find that you're enforcing a law in a way that you think is totally contrary to statute? What do you do in that situation? Their response is we need to follow the law as it's written. Right.
Sorry. Invariably, that means you are interpreting the statutes.
Right. Right.
And if you're going to enforce that interpretation, 227 is very clear you have to promulgate a rule unless there's an exemption. Now, you can get emergency rulemaking in certain situations, but you have to do a finding that there's an emergency. So it's not like the statutes or the agencies are handcuffed, but they have to go through that process in 227.
So
but
before, what would
you,
go ahead.
I'm sorry, just real quick. What would you like us to say about Schoolway?
Well, what I like about Schoolway is it sort of gave us a sort of a smell test on what's an interpretation of statute. The court in Schoolway, which we think the court was correct in this decision, said that an interpretation, there is no interpretation here, and there's no tools of statutory construction. I mean, so when you ask if there's an interpretation of the statutes, there is no quantitative interpretation. It's yes or no. Here, no question they're interpreting sub 11. There is no question. If you spend 7 pages and counsel will argue the interpretation, there's an interpretation going on. You can see by the arguments made in the court, is there being used tools of construction? Yes. There's 7 pages in Schoolway alone, not Schoolway, the appellate court decision, that uses syntax, that uses other construction techniques. So clearly, according to Schoolway, there's an interpretation going on here.
So if there's any interpretation of any statute ever in any way, shape, or form, there has to be rulemaking.
Unless there's an exception. It has to be an enforceable interpretation. Now, sometimes you get in that situation where we're making an interpretation guidance, but you know, it's an interpretation that is not apply here. Clearly, they're enforcing that interpretation through the sign removal order.
Counsel, does the word syntax appear in the Kalal case, which is the seminal case on statutory interpretation and tools for statutory interpretation?
I cannot speak to whether it is or not, but clearly the Court of Appeals is using several textualism tools, tools of interpretation. But in this situation, it's hard to argue after that we're here without an interpretation on sub 11. And it would be hard to see or imagine a court getting a case in which interpretation isn't a dispute. When you walk into an agency and about to engage in a dispute, you're arguing about interpretation. This should not be difficult in this case. Reviewing the appendix, the transcripts, from the get-go, they're arguing about the interpretation of the right to cure statute.
Thank you.
And it should have been promulgated. Thank you.
May it please the Court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Tom Bellavia, and I'm here today representing the Division of Hearings and Appeals, which made the case. I think this is a fairly simple case that has been made in the course of litigation to seem more complicated than it really is. What's at issue here, ultimately, is a single sign removal order issued by the Department of Transportation related to one specific sign, which was originally lawfully erected. Subsequently, the designation of the highway next adjacent to the sign was changed. It no longer became legal to have a sign at that location, but the sign was allowed to continue as a nonconforming use, a special dispensation that allows it to continue to exist, even though it doesn't conform with legal requirements, so long as certain conditions are met, including the condition that the sign not be enlarged. In this case, the sign was enlarged at various times over a period of time.
Counsel, quick question. So imagine if the sign for one day, McDonald's had a fantastic sale going on their French fries, and they had one French fry that extended just a little bit above the sign, say 2 feet, comes up one day, comes down one day. Is it the department's position that the sign is henceforth and forever illegal and therefore removable without just compensation?
I believe that is correct under the law as it existed at the time of the events in this case. The administrative rule that applies said that the sign cannot be enlarged, meaning the advertising surface area of the sign. In that example, the advertising surface would be enlarged.
The case that talks about that, the cites one case talking about the violation of a nonconforming use invalidates that use, transforming it into legal use. It essentially doesn't have a lot of explanation or rationale that's put in there. Basically, it's the idea is the policy argument behind nonconforming uses. Is there any law beyond that case that sort of substantiates the idea that something that's illegal for a day or nonconforming for a day, that somehow you lose all rights to continue nonconforming use, or is that really the authority that case we're relying on? Is there any other statute, any other legal authority for that notion?
That case certainly is some supporting authority. I did not do additional case law research into the underlying policy issue. I would just add that in this case, the administrative rules that were being applied specifically provided that any sign that was enlarged henceforth became an illegal sign subject to removal. So without regard to the prior court decision, that principle had been codified in the administrative rules that applied at the time.
Counsel, would you agree that DOT's prior practice of giving 60 days for a non-conforming sign to bring itself back into the parameters granted to it as a non-conforming sign was an interpretation of subsection 11?
I don't agree that it was an interpretation of subsection 11. I believe it was a practice. It was a practice of providing the right to cure that was available under subsection 11. Our position is that the language of subsection 11 does not apply to this sign.
I understand that's your present position, but I was wanting you to look back at an interpretation of subsection 11 that was, it appears, made by DOT in the past.
Yes. So going all the way back to the beginning, the 1972 Highway 19.09.
Well, I think through 1999, it
correct.
Appears
correct.
That it was the interpretation of DOT that a nonconforming sign, if it got out of whack, should be given 60 days to fix itself back up.
I would say it was the practice of DOT to provide a 60-day opportunity to cure.
What's the difference between a practice and an interpretation?
The difference is that the agency can provide the opportunity to cure without taking the position that opportunity to cure was required by that statute.
Well, if you apply it as a general rule, which it appears that it was applied as a general rule, why is that not statutory interpretation? Where else would the agency have authority to do anything?
Well, you could have an established practice of providing the opportunity to cure without taking the position that it was required by that statutory provision.
Okay, we're talking about this case, and my question to you is was it DOT interpreting subsection 11 when it granted that right to cure?
I do not believe that it was, and I think the Court of Appeals took the same position and said that the language of that original rule could be read as simply referring to the procedural part of subsection 11 and simply incorporating that procedure and applying it to this separate context.
I have another question for you. It involves 8430 subsection 6, subsection C. And DOT is wanting this sign to be taken down without just compensation. And 6 says the department shall pay just compensation upon the removal or relocation of any of the following signs, which are not then in conformity with the section, regardless of whether the sign was removed because of this section, and this section is 8430. And sub C says signs that are lawfully erected on or after March 18th. And the reason I've focused on that is that DOT not only wants a sign removed, which under certain circumstances that surely could happen, but they want it removed without paying just compensation.
That is correct.
Okay, and how did the DOT get to the position of saying this sign, which was lawfully erected, I think everyone agrees, after March 18th, 1972, how did it, DOT fall out of applying that statute and enacting a rule that permits removal of the sign with no payment?
Well, the rule definitely does provide that a sign loses its legal nonconforming status if it is illegally enlarged after it obtains that status, and that compensation doesn't apply in that circumstance.
Well, where in the statutes does the DOT have authority to stop paying compensation? So even if you're right on everything else, where in the statutes does it give DOT the authority to say, oh, if you fall out of nonconforming status, you're illegal and you get no compensation for your sign?
The statute does not expressly, the statute that existed at the time of the events in this case did not expressly refer to the issue of uncompensated removal of an enlarged nonconforming sign.
8430 sub 6 was in existence, wasn't it?
That provision was in existence.
Okay.
I would if I may just add one thing to your analysis, Justice Rosenkranz, which is this: the new statute, the 5BR, does expressly provide for uncompensated removal of signs in exactly this type of situation, setting aside the issue of the opportunity to cure.
But you're telling me that statute doesn't apply, right? So you want
that
to apply a little bit?
That statute doesn't apply to this case, but that provision coexists with 6C, suggesting that in the mind of the legislature, the compensation requirement under 6C does not apply to the category of nonconforming signs that are illegally changed, because the legislature has itself provided now for uncompensated removal of those signs.
You know, if you want to apply that statute to this case, I think it would be a very easy case.
I agree. It is an easy case if you apply that statute. I wasn't applying a statute to this case. I was making a comparison between the two sections. When
DOT enacted a rule that provided it could take someone's sign without just compensation, I couldn't find any statutory authority for that. And in fact, I found contrary authority in 8436C, which says it applies to any of the following signs, and one of them are signs lawfully erected on or after March 18, 1972, and certainly Lamar's sign fits.
I think I've answered the question to the extent that I'm. So the statutory authority for the rule is subsection 18 of the statute, which is a general grant of rulemaking authority to provide procedures for enforcing the requirements of the section. The premise of your question, though, is that it has to do with what the requirements of the section are.
That's right.
And so if your interpretation of that section is correct, then I believe your conclusion would follow. I would note that the petitioners have not taken the position that the rule in question was invalid. They've argued as to the interpretation of 201.10. They have not argued that 201.09 or 201.10 were statutorily unauthorized, nor did they follow the procedures for bringing that kind of a challenge in this case or raise that argument below.
Good. Thank you.
Counsel, is it your position that 201.10 sub E is the authority that prevents enlargement of Lamar's sign?
Sub 2, sub E, yes.
Mm-hmm. And what is the statutory authority for sub 2, sub E?
The only statutory authority for that provision is 8430 sub 18, which is the general grant of rulemaking authority. That's the only source of rulemaking authority in 8430.
Okay. So then the question becomes, I think, whether 18 is broad enough to enable the department to enact a broad-based prohibition against enlarging signs, because 5BM has a specific reference to not enlarging signs, correct? Okay. Why would it be necessary to have a specific prohibition against enlarging signs in BM if the agency can simply make rules prohibiting the enlargement of any sign?
I'm not sure. I guess I don't really think I understand the principle that you're applying. I don't think that it necessarily precludes DOT from providing for enforcement through that mechanism under these different circumstances that are not addressed in the statute. There's certainly no affirmative prohibition in the statute to doing it.
So the broad-based prohibition against enlarging any sign, what statutory requirement is that enforcing?
Well, there is no prohibition against enlarging any sign. There's only a prohibition against enlarging a nonconforming sign beyond the size that it had when it became nonconforming.
Where do you see that in the statutes?
Well, now it's in 5B. It's in 5BR.
Yes, but your position is 5BR does not apply, correct?
Correct. It wasn't there. That was specifically only in the administrative rules and not in the statute specifically at the time of the events in this case.
Okay. So in this, so if you are referring to sub 18 as the statutory authority to adopt a rule against enlarging signs, doesn't there have to be a statutory basis for not enlarging signs for the regulation to enforce?
I would have to go back and look more closely at the rules. I think the basis would be in sub 3 or sub 5. Again, the statute provides for the statute certainly in its previous iteration expressly provided for nonconforming status and indicated what nonconforming status was, and DOT provided a mechanism through the administrative rules for enforcing that by prohibiting changes, which was the common background understanding of how nonconforming uses work.
So what version of the statute are we applying?
Are we applying?
Yes.
We are applying the version that existed prior to April 2018.
Okay. And what specific language would you point to as a source of authority for the department to prohibit the enlargement sign?
Again, I do not believe there is any reference to the enlargement of signs in the statute as it existed at the time of,
thank you,
at issue here.
Counsel, I wanted to go back to 1909, and it was something that was raised by the opposition, and you did not respond to it in your brief, or at least as I recall. It seems to me that this was a contemporaneously enacted administrative rule, reflecting at least a permissible reading of the statute. That's the only way you can read it, that these things that become nonconforming subsequently nonconforming, you have a right to cure under sub 11. And that's what the department, day one, reads sub 11 to say. Even if I acknowledged your position that the Court of Appeals analysis and the arguments you make regarding how if I picked up sub 11 today and read it, whether it would apply to that or not, does this rule, and it's an enacted rule, it's not just a policy, it's an enacted rule, reflect the original kind of public meaning of the text of the rule? And if so, doesn't that acknowledge that we've had at least a change in interpretation, which might trigger the rulemaking requirement?
Well, to the extent that there was that there was an interpretation, I mean, stepping back, the position I took earlier, I continue to take, which is I do not believe that rule was an interpretation of what was required by subsection 11. But to the extent that it is viewed as such an interpretation, that rule was repealed and replaced in 1972. So there's a highway, in 1976. And in the new version of it, there's no longer any reference to that. The DOT did continue, nonetheless, to provide the opportunity to cure under the facts that are in the record in this case. But the rule itself that embodied that public declarations, for whatever its meaning is, was repealed and not continued in the subsequent version of the rule, which is identical to the current version.
Well, the new version actually, in 1976, repealed any reference. It doesn't necessarily say it didn't apply to the same group of people. The department continued to apply it.
It was silent on
the subject. So it's your position that this rule does not reflect an interpretation of sub 11, that effectually the department, even though sub 11, that the only reasonable interpretation of it doesn't allow a right to cure, the department was not interpreting the statute when it passed an administrative rule explicitly invoking the statute, giving these exact kinds of signs a right to cure?
Our position is that sub 11 on its face does not apply to nonconforming signs that were lawfully erected, and if it was incorrectly interpreted in the past, that was an incorrect interpretation of the plain terms of the statute.
If this court would find that rulemaking was required, what would be the appropriate remedy in this situation?
Let me think for a second. I think the only appropriate remedy and this is a 227 review of a sign removal order. I think that what you can do in that context is to invalidate the sign removal order. Now, the court's decision may contain guidance as to what rulemaking requirements are, which of course everyone would then pay attention to.
Counsel, isn't there an element of unfairness, regardless of whether you call it an interpretation of a statute or a practice or application, of changing the way it's interpreted or applied or the practice without notice and rulemaking to those who are being regulated?
I don't think fairness is the applicable legal standard. I think the agency prior to the change in practice, the agency chose not to exercise all of the enforcement authority that it lawfully possessed by withholding the removal order until after an opportunity to cure was provided. It later changed that practice and exercised the enforcement authority that it legally that it legally possessed. I don't think fairness is the decisive issue for purposes of this case.
Asking it another way, the same question Justice Ann Walsh Bradley just asked, had, and I kind of asked this to opposing counsel, had they not had this policy of the 60-day right to cure, your position is you don't have to do rulemaking, period. But isn't it more clear of a case to not have to do rulemaking had they not applied the 60-day? All right, let me ask it again. Didn't the 60-day application of giving them a right to cure, in your mind, that didn't change anything? You're saying that didn't change anything. We're in the same spot. Had they given it or not given it?
I'm sorry. I'm still not following.
Okay.
I apologize.
If you didn't ever have the department giving people 60 days to conform a non-conforming sign that they didn't have to give, and they never did that, that's a much stronger case for your argument, isn't it?
Certainly.
I guess I'm asking the same thing just as Ann Walsh Bradley asked. Isn't there something? What happens when an agency decides to treat people differently for a period of time and then take away that treatment? You're saying there's nothing that stems from that?
I think it's going to depend on what the treatment is and on the facts of the case. We have a decision in a specific case. We have a specific an order of that nature directed to a named party is expressly excluded from the definition of a rule that has to be promulgated. There's no reference in the order to subsection 11 because subsection 11 doesn't apply. So not applying a statute that doesn't apply isn't a rule. So it's only when you create this factual record in the course of litigation establishing a prior practice that now it becomes apparent that there was a difference in practices over time. But at the time, all the agency did was make a decision regarding an individual sign in an individual case, which is not a rule and does not require rulemaking, and it didn't apply a statute that on its face doesn't apply to the sign in this case.
How are regulated entities supposed to conduct their business or their affairs if they don't know how the regulating agency is going to apply a statute or a rule?
Well, I would respectfully respond that the regulated parties knew perfectly well from the administrative rule that enlarging a non-conforming sign was prohibited and that it would render the sign illegal and subject to removal. So the question really then comes down to, well, if the agency had a more lenient policy that allowed you to get away with it for a while if nobody was looking, then shouldn't they be allowed to continue doing that? And the agency shouldn't be permitted to enforce the requirement that was plainly on the books
the entire time. Well, is it okay then for the agency, for the next sign owner, to apply the 60-day cure period that they were applying in the past? I mean, that's the heart of my question. Does the agency have the license to, it's probably the wrong word to use when I'm talking about agencies, but do they have the leeway then to apply rules differently to different sign owners in this case?
No, certainly don't have the leeway to apply a rule arbitrarily to different sign owners. I think that what we have here is a single change of practice, as far as we can tell from the record, that occurred apparently with a change of administrations at the Department of Transportation. There isn't in a case where there was a record of an arbitrary jumping back and forth and an ongoing inconsistency in application, and I think that would be a different case that would raise different kinds of concerns.
Well, what if a new person came into this role in the agency and went back to the old interpretation a couple years later? Would that be okay?
It wouldn't be okay because, well, I mean, if the new person came in and read sub 11 as requiring a 60-day right to cure, that would be an incorrect reading of sub 11. If a new person came in and decided that as a matter of policy, we should provide a right to cure in these circumstances, that would be equivalent to the policy that existed prior to 1999, according to the record, and it's not legally precluded.
How would the regulated agency know whether sub 11 was being interpreted or they were just doing it as a matter of policy?
How would the regulated entity know that?
Right.
I'm not, I guess they wouldn't know it, but I'm not sure why it would make a difference whether it was, you know, it seems like it was only in the course of litigation after you're already litigating this that the question of the statutory authority or lack thereof would matter. I think what would matter to the regulated party was whether they were receiving the opportunity to cure or not. In this case, they simply received a sign removal order without a prior opportunity.
Does the agency ever need to give notice that it's changing its policy?
Agencies are free under the way our rules are structured. Agencies can act through rulemaking, and agencies are also allowed to make individual decisions. By necessity, they make individual decisions on a case-by-case basis. Our legislature acknowledged that by exempting individual decision-making from the definition of an administrative rule.
It strikes me that there may be some due process concerns, though. Again, if you have the agency flipping its policy from time to time and applying it differently to different entities because, again, you have somebody come into the position who makes these decisions and they see it differently than their predecessor did. We can't have that, can we?
I agree that there can be a due process concern theoretically, but my response is that the degree of process that's provided by the rulemaking process is exceeded by the degree of process that's provided in the procedures for judicial review of an order in an individual case. So if an agency adopts an incorrect interpretation of a statute in an individual order, that interpretation is still subject to judicial review, and this court or any reviewing court can conclude that interpretation was incorrect. So I think the regulated entity receives due process in any case in which there is an individual, in any individualized case in which they've received an order, because they get judicial review of that.
Is there anything in the record regarding whether Omar had knowledge of the change in policy? When they bought the sign, as I recall, in 96, the changes occurred 2007 to 2009. It's been represented that the change in policy occurred in 1999. Is there any record that they knew about the change in no longer having the right to cure?
I am not aware of anything in the record reflecting when Lamar became aware of the change in policy. I think Lamar is a big company that owns lots and lots of signs, so I suspect this case might not have been the first time that the issue ever came up, but I'm speculating, and I think that Lamar's counsel could perhaps be in a better position to answer that question. I did want to touch on the question that Justice Kelly asked earlier about the interpretation of 5BR and whether which provision of 5BR2 applied there. Let me just grab it. So if we go to 5BR2, it talks about signs described in sub 3A, D, E, F, or H. D and E are the subsections that apply to nonconforming signs. D is nonconforming signs erected before 1972, and E is nonconforming signs erected after 1972. So 3E is the provision that's applicable to the sign in this case, and that's the provision that they're now in, that the sign ceased to conform with in 1996 when the highway was reclassified. Touching very quickly on the question of the interpretation of Trans 201 of Trans 201.10, which hasn't been talked about yet, I really think that that Lamar's interpretation of that rule just simply doesn't work as a matter of too many absurd results. The entire point of nonconforming status is that the status that was lawful at the time when the use became nonconforming is locked in, and then you're not supposed to substantially change that or you lose your right to continue the nonconforming use. If the date, therefore, for making determinations about the status of a nonconforming use is the date when the use became nonconforming. The rule uses awkward language for that, referring to the effective date of the state law. That could refer to, if a new law came into existence, a new state law that rendered a use nonconforming, then that could then the effective date of that law would be the date on which the use became nonconforming and therefore is the relevant date. In this case, a pre-existing provision in 8430 became applicable to this sign when the highway was reclassified in 1996. That was the effective date of the state law for purposes of this sign. It is not the most natural use of language, I will admit. My red light is on. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So much to say, so little time to say it. And for some reason, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory comes to mind. I think that was used there somewhere. Question, Justice Hagedorn, was there anything in this record to indicate that Lamar had prior knowledge of this change of interpretation? Actually, to the contrary, there's something in the record that indicates they were completely surprised by it. And I would refer you to the testimony of William P.
Counsel, before you do that, would you get back before the mic? Because we're on the record tape-wise, and our sound system in here is tentative, if nothing else.
I apologize,
no problem.
Justice.
No problem.
I blanked. The petitioner's appendix, starting at page 218 and going on for several pages, is testimony by Bill Mitchell. Bill Mitchell is the general manager of the Central Wisconsin office of Lamar. And that testimony is very clear that Mr. Mitchell was completely taken off guard by this change in interpretation. I think you'll find that in those pages, Justice. The sign in question was in the jurisdiction of the Marshfield office where Mr. Mitchell is the general manager. It's always fun in a case like this to find something that counsel agree on. And counsel agree that the section that you were looking for, Justice Kelly, is 8430 sub 3 sub E. That's the one. Bingo. My partner doesn't let me handle technology too often, but he's making an exception. In section 227.10, statements of policy and interpretations of law and so forth are the rules that talk about when rules are necessary and so forth. And in sub 1, it makes it clear each agency shall promulgate as a rule each statement of general policy and each interpretation of a statute. So if council suggests that there's a difference between the two, we would respectfully disagree.
Counsel, are you challenging, just to Justice Kelly's question, are you challenging whether there's authority to remove signs without compensation, or would you assert that there is no authority to remove signs without any compensation?
Yeah, in our brief, we've mentioned a number of times, Justice, I think, as you know, that we don't find anything in Section 84.30 that provides for the uncompensated removal of signs that were erected legally after March 18 of 1972 and that later became nonconforming. It doesn't exist. That's our view. We've looked pretty hard, and we've worked with this statute for a lot of years. The question came up about fairness, I think, from...
Well, hey, Council, before you go there, 5BM would allow for uncompensated removal of signs, correct?
Yes, but which applies only to on-premises
right.
signs.
Right. But that's the only part of the... Would you agree that that's the only part of the statute that allows for uncompensated removal of signs?
Yes.
Okay.
Question came up. I believe it was from Justice Walsh Bradley and followed up a moment later by Justice Dalek about fairness. And I think it's instructive. I need a longer boom on the mic or longer arms. I think it's instructive to note a very interesting paragraph written by the administrative law judge, which appears in the final decision by DHA on that very subject about fairness of a change in policy. The administrative law judge in the final decision says, and I quote, "There is an element of unfairness on the part of the department to abandon its practice, giving notice of a violation and providing an opportunity to cure a violation without a warning to sign owners," and then he goes on. If we had just been with him as he wrote that, we would have been cheering to that point because that was exactly our point. But then it took a strange twist. The administrative law judge decided that what we were asking for was something in equity to solve the problem and decided that he had no such powers. And then the issue went away in the final decision by DHA. But we weren't, and of course we weren't there sitting at his elbow as he wrote. We were simply asking that a rule was required, and if a rule was not issued, as indeed there was not one here, then it was unfair for this enforcement action to take place. So I would commend that language to you. It appears at Petitioner's Appendix 402 to 403. And I'm out of time, I'm sorry.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you both for good arguments, and you did a good job with your 5 minutes, and you all were very helpful with the court. I think sometimes counsel gets asked questions that you don't anticipate, and it's fair to say, hey, I didn't anticipate that. Thank you very much for very good arguments and excellent briefs. We're going to take a recess now, and we'll come back for our third case at 1:30. We are adjourned.